academic and researcher from Topeka, Kansas. Thank you for your thoughts. Shelby Risby, Managing Director at IFSA London, who spoke to us from London, and at the top of our program, Kamran Yusuf, our correspondent, spoke to us from Islamabad. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From me, Kaveh Tafawi, and the entire team, is goodbye. Until the next time.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. And now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. قل إن صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم بما كنتم فيه تختلفون وهو الذي جاء جعلكم خلائف الأرض ورفع بعضكم فوق بعض درجات ليبلوكم فيما آتاكم إن ربك سريع العقاب وإنه لغفور رحيم صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things. And no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land, and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
Look at our top stories this hour. Russia and Ukraine trade accusations over the Kramatorsk attack. Moscow urges the West to stop arming Ukraine, while Kyiv appeals for more heavy weapons. Palestinian resistance groups blast certain regional states for their criticism of the latest operation in Tel Aviv, saying self-defense against occupation is allowed under international law. Also ahead, Pakistan's parliament is gearing up for a no-confidence vote in a motion expected to decide the fate of Prime Minister Imran Khan. Thank you for joining us. Ukraine has called for harsher sanctions against Russia over a missile attack in the eastern city of Kramatorsk that left 50 people dead. President Volodymyr Zelensky called the strike a deliberate attack on civilians. He said Kyiv expected a firm global response to what he called this war crime. Zelensky also demanded more weapons, saying any delay in providing arms for Ukraine would mean politicians want to help Moscow more than Kyiv. He also demanded an energy embargo on Russia and called for all Russian banks to be cut off from the global system. Meanwhile, Russia has called on Western nations to stop supplying weapons to Ukraine in the wake of the missile attack that hit a train station. Moscow blames the Ukrainian military for the strike.
Today, on April 8th, the Ukrainian military struck the railway station of Kramatorsk with a Tochka-U missile. Tochka-U missiles, which remains were found near the railway station, are used only by the Ukrainian military.
Russia's defense ministry also says the missiles were launched from a Donbas territory controlled by Ukrainian forces. A U.S. defense official also says the Russian military used a short-range ballistic missile to strike the site. The 45-day war in Ukraine has left at least 4,000 people dead and displaced over 11 million others. The European Union is adding more than 200 individuals to its blacklist of sanctions against Russia over its military operation in Ukraine. The list includes two daughters of the Russian president, as well as top businessmen, politicians, and military staff close to the Kremlin. The sanctions also target officials from Luhansk and Donetsk in eastern Ukraine. The restrictions include asset seizures and travel bans in the EU. The bloc has sanctioned around 700 people linked to Russia and slapped tough economic sanctions on the country since it moved on Ukraine. In response, Moscow has announced retaliatory measures against European countries. China has warned of, quote, serious consequences of Russia's suspension from the UN Human Rights Council. It says the move will simply fan the flames of war in Ukraine.
The drafting process of the relevant resolution was not open or transparent, nor did it follow the practice of going through consultations of all member states and heeding views extensively. This way of doing things will only aggravate the division among member states, intensify contradictions among the parties concerned, and add fuel to the fire, which is not conducive to de-escalating the conflict, still less pushing for peace negotiations. To handle the issue of membership of the Human Rights Council this way will set a new dangerous precedent, further intensifying confrontation and induce a still bigger impact on the UN governance system with serious consequences.
Zhao Lijian also stated that China is against politicizing human rights to pressure other countries. The Chinese official cautioned against what he called a selective approach toward the issue of human rights. This after the UN General Assembly voted to suspend Russia from the Human Rights Council. China was among the 24 countries against the U.S.-initiated motion. Meantime, Moscow has labeled the vote illegal and politically driven. Russia stands accused of human rights violations and abuses in Ukraine, but the Kremlin denies the accusation. Iran says fighting the Israeli regime is a legitimate and clear right of Palestinians in self-defense. Tehran says international bodies should prevent the regime from committing further atrocities against the Palestinian people. Foreign Ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh says resistance is a response to the repeated crimes and atrocities of Israel against Palestinians and their sanctities. Khatibzadeh says Israel's daily crackdown, killing, and open terrorism is the root cause of all instabilities in the occupied territories. The spokesman says the only solution is holding a referendum with the participation of all original residents of Palestine. He also says resistance is the only way forward to force the Israeli regime to accept such a democratic solution. Meanwhile, Palestinian resistance groups defend the recent retaliatory operation in Tel Aviv, slamming the regional countries that condemned the incident. A spokesman for Hamas resistance movement deplored Turkey and Bahrain for their critical stance. Azam Qasem said Palestinians are acting in self-defense, which is backed by international law. The Islamic Jihad movement separately reacted to the condemnations by Turkey, Bahrain, and the United Arab Emirates. The movement said Palestinians pay no attention to such remarks. Both groups also slammed the Palestinian Authority for denouncing the attack. They said the comments by its officials only serve the Israeli regime's propaganda against Palestinians.
After an hours-long manhunt throughout Tel Aviv, Israeli forces clashed with Raad Hazem and killed him in Yaffa. 28-year-old Raad Hazem from Jenin refugee camp in the north of the occupied West Bank was the Palestinian man who opened fire in Dizengoff shopping street in central Tel Aviv Thursday night, killing two Israelis and wounding nine others. The Palestinian resistance groups praised the operation, describing it as heroic. Hamas resistance groups said it proves resistance is continuing and escalating, while the Islamic Jihad said the operation confirmed how fragile the Israeli regime is.
The assassination of any Palestinian, Tel Aviv's crimes, and aggression on Al-Aqsa Mosque is responded by more heroic operations. So it's a natural and legitimate response. Israel must expect that any future steps or crimes would definitely drag such reactions.
Following the operation, more than 1,000 police officers joined a manhunt, while the Israeli settlers were ordered to get off the streets and remain at home. Experts say the operation that was the latest string of deadly operations across the occupied territories and the fourth in 2.5 weeks had confused the Israeli regime and proved its weakness.
This operation in particular has really shocked the Israeli society, and the Israeli regime is broken on all levels, even the security level, because they deal with the Palestinian as a security problem and not people having political and historic rights. This operation is telling them that Palestinians exist as real owners and they have a right in these lands.
Meanwhile, Israeli military has declared its forces will be on high alert in Al-Quds for the first Friday prayers of the holy month of Ramadan. The Israeli police bolstered their forces in Al-Quds, and more troops have stationed on the numerous checkpoints in the occupied West Bank, imposing more strict measures against the Palestinians. Palestinians say the Israeli military thought its crackdown and aggression following the March 22nd operation that claimed four Israeli lives led to a state of calm in the occupied territories. However, Ra'ad Hazem's Thursday attack that killed two more Israelis reminded the regime that the entire Palestinian lands are occupied and that the resistance continues. Mona Kandil occupied Ramallah.
And security is beefed up around Pakistan's parliament as it convenes to vote on whether Prime Minister Imran Khan should stay in office. The country's top court has ordered a no-confidence vote that could lead to Khan's dismissal. The premier has accepted the verdict but insisted that he was a victim of a regime change conspiracy involving the U.S. Pakistan embroiled into a political crisis last week after a key ally of the ruling party switched side, prompting the opposition to issue a no-trust motion. However, Khan blocked the process and dissolved parliament. After days of hearings, the Supreme Court on Friday announced Khan's move unlawful. If he loses the no-confidence vote, the opposition will choose a new prime minister. Shehbaz Sharif, the younger brother of three-time former premier Nawaz Sharif, is the potential candidate to rule the South Asian country until the next polls. Italy's nurses and healthcare workers have staged a national strike affecting hospitals across the country. Unionists are calling on the government to review the collective contract, adjusting salaries to meet changes in skyrocketing cost of living.
On Friday, tens of thousands of nurses and non-medical health professionals walked off their job and staged a nationwide strike, demanding improved pay and better nurse-to-patient ratios. The industrial action had been called by a number of healthcare unions in response to the government's inaction that had followed another strike called in January. Italy's nurses have been celebrated as heroes for treating desperately ill coronavirus patients, often with little equipment and knowledge of the illness. However, today they feel forgotten.
In the midst of the pandemic, the Prime Minister himself said we won't forget about the nurses. The truth is that they have forgotten about us. We were expecting a pay raise considering the challenges and the suffering we had to go through during the pandemic. Negotiations are underway for the contractual renewal of the health sector. Let's see how it unfolds.
About 450,000 nurses are currently employed in Italy, a country with a population of about 60 million people. According to a recent OECD report, the average gross annual salary for nurses is among the lowest in Europe, while the ratio between nurses and the population is 6 per 1,000 inhabitants, against 18 in Switzerland and Norway, 13 in Germany, and 11 in France.
The pandemic has further shown that a shortage of nurses is greatly affecting Italy's healthcare system. Nurses are exhausted today. They had to go through insurmountable challenges during the COVID crisis, including the lack of appropriate gear, knowledge, and the high number of patients. Also, some mismanagement on the part of the hospital administrations made things harder. In some regions where hospitals are run mostly by private companies, the healthcare system has collapsed catastrophically because of the COVID.
Privatized and commercialized, Italy's healthcare system has been thrown upside down over the past 20 years. A system in which private and public clinics compete for taxpayers' money came into play in 1997 when Rome opted to decentralize the Italian healthcare system and give more autonomy to regional governments. Lombardy is one of the Italian regions where the healthcare private sector is largely supported by public funding. It was also one of the worst-hit regions in Europe by COVID-19 and the epicenter at the beginning of the European outbreak. Experts believe that Lombardy's fragmented healthcare system snarled the lines of command across the region, throwing hospitals into chaos. that caused the deaths of thousands of people during the first wave of COVID in Italy. Max Civili, Rome.
Muslim voters have swung French elections in the past, and they appear set to play the same quote-unquote kingmaker role this April. After 5 years with President Emmanuel Macron, few Muslims believe he is a cult centrist anymore, and many are even prepared to vote for the far right. Rami Mazohiri reports from Paris.
As voters go to the first round presidential polls this weekend, many French Muslims no longer see Emmanuel Macron as the centrist which he claimed to be in 2017. If Nicolas Sarkozy introduced Islamophobia and François Hollande made it acceptable to the mainstream, Macron's term institutionalized Islamophobia. Macron immediately took Hollande's multi-year state of emergency and legalized it, with Muslims the clear targets and practically the only victims. His so-called anti-separatist law of 2021 tried to ban the hijab for minors and clearly violated constitutional protections for the freedom of association, worship, and politics. It was so heavy-handed, even the United Nations and English language media widely criticized it.
Emmanuel Macron lance son projet sur le séparatisme.
When Macron launched his anti-separatism law, which hurt Muslims so badly, it was a clear bid to join the far right. We saw that he was using their same ideas and preferred methods, and that he was doing it in broad daylight.
In the months preceding the election, nearly 100 mosques have been raided, with at least 24 shut down so far. Top Muslim NGOs and local community centers have also been exiled or closed. A new report revealed that these closures were based merely on secretive evidence, which is to say no evidence was ever produced in court.
Sur la radicalisation, on a entendu de tout et n'importe quoi.
His government has produced so much nonsense, like when they said having a beard was a sign of being a radical Muslim or taking Ramadan seriously. His politics are clearly identity politics, and that's a real danger. His objective is to have a seat at the table with the other far-right politicians.
Not apologizing for massacres during the war against Algerian independence, keeping the Arab Nelson Mandela, Georges Ibrahim Abdullah, in prison, enacting legislation which falsely equates anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism, gutting social services and help for poor, largely immigrant areas. Many Muslims say they are prepared to vote against Macron in the second round, whomever the candidate. In 2012, 93% of over 2 million Muslim voters picked Hollande over Sarkozy, providing the decisive margin in an extremely tight contest. In 2022, Muslims may play a similar role of kingmaker, but it's still not sure which side they will pick. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Turkey was long spearheading efforts to bring those involved in the brutal assassination of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi to justice. Turkey has taken a U-turn on the case, surprising many who were hoping for some kind of punishment for the culprits.
The world will never forget the gruesome killing of outspoken journalist Jamal Khashoggi by a Saudi hit squad in 2018. Khashoggi was strangled at the Saudi consulate in Istanbul and then dismembered by a forensic scientist who worked for Saudi intelligence. The killing was caught on listening devices planted by Turkish intelligence. The Saudi dissident's body was then cut to pieces and taken to the Turkish Consul General's residence, where it is believed to have been burned. No remains have ever been found. The brutal murder severely strained ties between Ankara and Riyadh and led to an unofficial Saudi boycott of Turkish exports. It cut Ankara's exports to Riyadh by 90%. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan was particularly vociferous in his condemnation of the Saudi government. He said Khashoggi was killed in cold blood by a death squad sent from Riyadh, and that it had been established that his murder was premeditated. The Turkish president said the operation had been ordered at the highest levels of the Saudi government. His assessment was supported by a U.S. intelligence report which said Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman had personally approved the assassination. There has been almost no doubt that the order to kill came from very high up in the Saudi government. And Turkey was widely seen as the most unrelenting force behind efforts to bring those responsible for the assassination to justice. But Ankara has suddenly changed course. On Thursday, a Turkish court halted the trial of Saudi suspects and transferred the case to Saudi Arabia.
Well, that's your world news for now. Stay tuned.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
On Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite, words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me, in full, in the days gone by. O, the Most Merciful.
Ramadan, the month of opportunities. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. 14 centuries ago, when the entire Arabian Peninsula was plunged in ignorance and superstitions, the messenger of mercy, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, said, "Fast to be healthy." It is believed in different religions that fasting is useful for both the body and the spirit. Fasting has been prescribed for other religions before Islam, and even some of non-Abrahamic religions have had a form of fasting in a specific period in year or for specific purposes. Stay tuned, please. Fasting was there among Christians and Jews. Interestingly, the non-Abrahamic religions had also called on their followers to refrain from eating during specific days. In ancient Greek, people used to go to famous temple for treatment of their sickness. Then they would fast after bathing and would ask the relevant deity to cure their patient. Hinduism has prevailed in the subcontinent and adjacent regions since 3 or 4,000 years BC. The adherents of this religion usually fast on the first days of the new month and during religious festivities. Fasting in this religion includes full refraining from solid foods and drinks for 24 hours, and everyone decides on how to fast. The aim of this fasting is to increase the thought and internal refining. The followers of Buddhism usually fast on the 14th day of every month, abstaining from solid foods. The followers of Manichaeism used to observe certain rituals during fasting. They had two kinds of fasting. One of them included abstention from eating and drinking for 2 days, and the other one was from morning till evening. The temples of Manichaeans were called Manestan, and there were 5 salons in every temple, one of which was related to fasting people and their prayers. They would determine the time of fast according to astrological evidence and would celebrate the last day of the month. They used to confess their sins while holding the picture of Manichaeus. Some historical accounts show that fast was common even among idolaters. It was done for satisfying idols. Why has fasting been so prevalent among various nations and various creeds? This may have originated in the fact that the first person who fasted was Prophet Adam. According to the narrations, when Adam ate from the forbidden tree, it was in his stomach for 30 days. Hence, God obligated 30 days of abstention from eating and drinking for him and his race. So, fasting has been inherited from our forefathers. Exegetes and experts of Islamic sciences have discussed if the blessed month of Ramadan had been called the same among the past nations or not. Some say that Ramadan is the name that had been there since the era of ignorance. Others maintain that Ramadan is the name that Islam has put on the month. Some others believe that when months were being called, they were called according to the time they coincided with. For instance, Ramadan was called such as it coincided with intensive heat of summer. Yet, there is evidence that Ramadan was called the same even before Islam. This is true for Dhul-Hajjah too. Generally, any nation that was beleaguered by a trouble or calamity, it would vow to fast and worship God. This way, they would show their misery and inability and confess their sins to satisfy God. God says in Ayah 183 of Surah Baqarah that fasting had been prescribed in the religions before Islam. Here, God wants to say that although fasting may seem hard, it had been prescribed for other nations and religions before Islam. God also stresses that the aim of fasting is to gain God-weariness. Fasting has been mentioned in the Old and New Testaments. It is said in the Bible that in all times among every ethnicity and nation, fasting was common during sorrows and unexpected trouble. The Bible of Luke reads that Prophet Jesus ordered his disciples to fast after his death. We also read in the Torah that Prophet Moses fasted for 40 days. It has also been mentioned in the Torah that the Jews used to fast when they wanted to express humbleness on the order to gain God's satisfaction. The Noble Quran is a great book which will remove curtains and show us realities if we contemplate its ayahs with pure heart. Today, scientists have reached the fact that there are myriads of mysteries in different parts of this book. God says in Ayah 29 of Surah Sa'd, "It is a blessed book that we have sent down to you, so that they may contemplate its signs and that those who possess intellect may take admonition." God has mentioned the aim of sending down the Quran so that people are not content with mere recitation of its ayahs. They are rather recommended to reflect upon the meanings of ayahs to be admonished. The commander of the faithful and the leader of the pious, Imam Ali, peace upon him, says, "Think deeply on the ayahs of the Qur'an, because thinking deeply and reflection on the Qur'an is the spring of hearts."
This is IRIB English Radio. Website is www.parstoday.com/en.
our home.
Under the blue sky, and a little further beyond these high mountains, there are people who have interesting words to say. Some of them look for a shoulder to cry on, but not every pain can be described. Not that they don't want to speak. Rather, some just don't know where to start from. Perhaps words cannot bear the burden of such a volume of distress. Maybe they don't want to remember someone or something. But deep down, they have stories to tell. At first glance, you may think this place is somewhere like any other place on the planet, a village in which a people dwell. But if you look closer, you will find traces of civilization. Under the same blue sky, and on the foothills of this high mountain, lies thousands of years of history and civilization. A mountain near San'ar, known among the locals as Fanjatan. The children of Fanjatan Mountain are the heirs of Yemen's thousand-year-old civilization. But today, they are not famous for such a heritage. Rather, it goes back to a few years ago when a Saudi fighter jet left little Athena visually impaired and took the lives of her family members. Bathena was one of the children of the mountain of Fanjatan and a neighbor of Sare. Sare has vivid memories of Bathena. Bathena and her sisters used to play with Sare. Fanjatan Mountain will surely miss the innocent laughs and cries of these girls, most of whom were martyred. Bathena was abducted, and now Sare is left with only her memories. It is the first night of the lunar month of Dhulhijja. Those who are eligible have arrived in Mecca, gradually preparing themselves to go to the Arafat Desert and celebrate Eid al-Adha. Those who couldn't make it for the pilgrimage follow the rituals and ceremonies from afar. They weep for not being able to carry out the pilgrimage, yet they celebrate the Eid. Meanwhile, in the midst of this rain of love, there seems to be other thoughts crossing the mind of the custodian of the Kaaba. Everything looks calm. The Eid is also a good excuse to slightly heal the wounds of the war. For 3 years, the people of Yemen have become familiar with the sound of Saudi fighter jets roaring in the sky. But it's hard to believe that this time, the ambassador of death is after you and your family. Sare looks up to her father and her only brother, Nayef, who is almost 4 years old, and whom God has given to Uncle Ahmed's family after 30 years. We should appreciate what might seem simple joys of the day, since the future is unclear. After playing that night, little Nayef became exhausted and went to sleep. He certainly didn't know what he was about to experience a few minutes later. Outside of this house, the district of Fanjatan was silent in the night. It was about 2 hours past midnight when the sound of a missile broke the silence. The wild sound of the explosions had shocked the people. Women and children were crying. Uncle Ahmad remembers well that Bathena's father was trying to save his wife and his 6 children at that time. But it was as if nobody was meant to stay alive, except for Bathena. Yet, it wasn't clear where Bathena was. Even after bombing the area, it seems that Saudi fighter jets have come to stay and want to test their newly received bombs on the poor people of this village. There is an interval between the third and fourth bombardments. The people of Fajatan were in shock after the first three airstrikes. After Uncle Ahmad sheltered his wife and children in the bathroom, he goes to the patio of the building to give comfort to his neighbors. At the same time, the Saudi fighter jets return to bomb their main target, the residential buildings. The last words, the last cries, and the last appeals. How much can little Sara take? For how long can she keep all these bitter memories? Meanwhile, Uncle Ahmad heard the last cries of Naif and Shuruk. He could hear nothing else but the voices of his children. But he too was stuck under the rubble and couldn't move. It's hard to see your loved ones calling for help and not being able to do anything for them. Sare was fortunate. The explosion had caused their dining table to move and act like a shield, protecting Sare from the falling rubble. Perhaps if this didn't happen, Sare too could have lost her life. Although it was still possible that the fighter jets would return to the scene, the people and rescue forces converged on the destroyed buildings, buildings that were now nothing but a heap of cement, brick, and iron. The bombs had separated 50-year-old Uncle Ahmad from his family. Everyone was in a different hospital in the city. Wounds caused by fragments and rubble are painful, but psychological wounds can be worse. Doctors tell all relatives and friends who come to visit Sare not to speak about the death of Naif and Shuruk. Finally, after a few days, the whole family receives the sad news. Now, the daughters of Uncle Ahmad realize they should no longer expect to see their little brother Naif and sister Shuruk. Uncle Ahmad's neighbors were also struck by grief. Fajatan mourns the death of its children. Each person has their own story, like the family of Ali al-Adini, who lived on the floor above Uncle Ahmad's house. He and his wife had four daughters and three sons. On that fateful night, after the bomb had struck, the second floor collapsed on Uncle Ahmad's family, and one of al-Adini's sons named Muhammad died. The third floor tenants of Uncle Ahmad's building were Mujahid al-Raishi, his wife, and two children. The explosion throws the members of this family into the air. They all survived, but shrapnel tears Mujahid's stomach. Several fragments also pierce the heads of the two children. Neighbors said Mujahid's wife was thrown by the impact of the explosion and got stuck to a piece of wood. But the fourth floor neighbor was not so lucky. A young Palestinian and his wife, who, after being displaced, had come to live in the house of Uncle Ahmad. Witnessing all these painful scenes within a few minutes scrapes the human soul, especially when one sees an injured mother who cannot relieve the pains of the family. The explosion that night was just the beginning of a period of continued pains for Naif. Uncle Ahmad and the girls started treating Naif. After the initial steps, the doctor puts a belt on the mother's spine to stabilize it. Treating the fragments also continued. 6 months pass. Uncle Ahmad and his daughters assume that the problem has been resolved. Little did they know, the shrapnel wounds had begun to swell. Before March 2015, when the Saudi war on Yemen began, Uncle Ahmad had a good life. He had a four-story building with tenants on three of the floors, a grocery on the main street of the city, as well as a taxi. But the war took everything from Ahmad. The jet fighters bombarded his building twice. For the first time, just days after the start of the airstrikes on Yemen, a fierce attack with phosphorus weapons took the lives of 84 people and injured 495 others. Uncle Ahmad's building and his grocery store were destroyed in the first assault. Ahmad repaired his building by all means and resumed life. But on that night, the same building was blown up with all its inhabitants. A man who once had everything now faces a difficult time. Doctors say that Umar Naif should continue cancer treatment in Egypt. The loss of Naif and Shuruq is still agonizing. He wants to save his wife, but he has nothing. His building has been destroyed. He decides to borrow money in return for his land and send Umar Naif to Egypt. Uncle Ahmad borrowed another 3 million riyals from his friends and relatives and spent the 6 million riyals on his wife. It would be a long journey for Umar Naif and her injured body. They go to Aden by car and then get on a plane. Umar Naif's treatment lasted 3 months in Egypt. It's a hard period for the family. The children are extremely worried about their mother, worried that they might receive sad news from Egypt. The hard days of waiting were over. Umar Naif came back to be with Uncle Ahmad and her daughters. However, she still has difficulty in moving around. The mother of the family has returned, but we cannot call her Umar Naif anymore, since there only remains a picture of little Naif and his kind sister Shuruq. The memories of Naif and his last moans break the heart of Uncle Ahmad. Sare has much to say, but not everything can be said. Sare reviews her memories. These eyes have seen a lot of suffering. Hard days eventually pass. Physical wounds ultimately heal. But a wounded heart takes time to heal.
National Day of Nuclear Technology. In the name of God, Salam and welcome to the program. April 9, 2006 was the day in which Iran announced achievement of uranium enrichment technology and a start of the full enrichment cycle in Natanz, central Iran. It was a turning point in the history of the Islamic Republic's endeavor in the field of peaceful nuclear technology. Following this success, the country entered the club of countries possessing the uranium enrichment know-how and technology. In view of this, the day was named as the National Day of Nuclear Technology to appreciate and glorify the efforts of young Iranian scientists. The Islamic Republic of Iran has covered a very arduous course to achieve nuclear technology. In 1958, Iran became a member of the International Atomic Energy Agency, IAEA, and in 1968 signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, NPT, which was ratified in the Iranian Parliament in 1970. In 1967, the United States had sold the first research 5-megawatt light water reactor to Iran for producing radio medicines. The American company AMF installed the reactor and put it into action in Tehran University. It was also committed to provide the 20-megawatt fuel needed by the reactor. Iran's Atomic Energy Organization has taken over the reactor and the fuel bars are made indigenously. According to the studies, with construction of nuclear power plants, over 20 megawatts of electricity are to be produced from nuclear energy. According to the reports, Iran had planned in 1974 to indigenize the full nuclear cycle within 20 years and provide 23 megawatts of electricity via 22 power plants. In view of this, contracts were concluded with Germany and France. Germany started construction of 2 1,000-megawatt reactors in Bushehr in 1970s, but it gave up the job after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, despite 85% progress. France, too, started construction of 360-megawatt reactor in Dar Huayn in Khuzestan province in 1970s, which was left unfinished after the victory of the Islamic Revolution. After the victory of the Islamic Revolution and establishment of the Islamic Republic, the U.S. and its regional accomplices made broad efforts to overthrow the Islamic Republic, which culminated in the imposed war, which lingered for 8 years. Iran's peaceful nuclear activities were also affected by the war, and more than a decade the program was halted. The Western regimes not only failed to fulfill their commitment to finishing the nuclear plants, they also assisted Iraq in bombarding these facilities, especially that of Bushehr. Thus, the nuclear plant inflicted serious damages. But from 1989, the first steps were taken for the revival of the peaceful nuclear program. The Islamic Republic of Iran considered Russia as a substitute for Germany, and in 1994, the contract was signed between the two countries to finish and put into action the nuclear plant in Bushehr. In 1998, the contract was revised, and the facility entered the operational cycle of producing electricity in 2011 after several tests. In 2003, the ballyhoo of counter-revolutionary and anti-Iran Western media on Iran's efforts to achieve atomic weapons technology caused sensitivity of Europe and the U.S., urging them to halt Iran's peaceful nuclear activities with various pretexts. But in 2006, the Iranian scientists and experts reached a new generation of centrifuges and announced it to the IAEA, hence making the nation a member of the Club of Nations possessing uranium enrichment technology. The Iranian government signed some agreements with the European parties, which gradually led to suspension of its nuclear activities and even studies. In the first year of the next government, the Islamic Republic announced the end of voluntary suspension of enrichment and that it would continue the activities of Isfahan UCF facilities under the IAEA supervision. This caused the Western media horns to fabricate allegations on Iran's tilting toward military program, and finally the issue was sent to the United Nations Security Council. After many ups and downs on Iran's peaceful nuclear program and passing several resolutions to sanction Iran, numerous rounds of talks between Iran and the so-called 5+1, the five self-imposed prominent members of the UNSC and Germany, bore fruit in July 2015 in the form of an agreement. The agreement imposed unconventional limitations on Iran's activities, facilities and substances, and remarkably increased the number of IAEA inspectors. Thus, Iran accepted to voluntarily implement the additional protocol, and the UN was committed to remove sanctions stipulated in the UNSC 2231 resolution. Iran and the 5+1 reached an agreement on July 14, 2015, which became famous as Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA. Contrary to Iran's good intention and full commitment to its JCPOA obligations, the U.S. has never kept its promises and commitments and has not removed even a single sanction against the country. Then, American President Donald Trump tore the agreement in front of TV cameras in May 2018 to show the U.S. unilateral approach in global issues. Washington has ever since imposed the harshest sanctions against Iran within the framework of the so-called maximum pressure. The remaining four European governments have bluntly obeyed the U.S. in failing to fulfill their JCPOA commitments. This made Tehran to decrease its nuclear commitments in five steps. In view of this, the Iranian parliament ratified the law for the government to take new steps to expand nuclear activities. Among these steps, mention can be made of the 20% uranium enrichment, putting forward the issue of the 60% enrichment, production of metal uranium, and expansion of nuclear facilities and equipment. The new approach by the Iranian parliament and government has seriously warned the U.S. and its accomplices and cohorts, especially the fake regime of Israel as the biggest possessor of atomic bombs and weapons in the region. The Islamic Republic of Iran has announced that it would return its JCPOA commitments if the U.S. removes all sanctions and returns to the deal. In spite of the fact that the Islamic Republic of Iran is pursuing a fully peaceful nuclear program, the United States and its European allies have resorted to the issue to accuse Iran of trying to achieve nuclear weapons. This allegation has many times been proved to be baseless by the IAEA inspectors and even the U.S. fair analysts and congressmen. Yet, in March 2021, the Biden administration issued a document known as Temporary Directive of National Security Strategy, in which the unfounded allegations have been repeated against Iran. In sum, it appears that the U.S. is scared of Iran's ability and power in every arena. Australian political expert Caitlin John Stone says Biden's policies on Iran are the same Trump policies on the country. The United States and its partners in crime, particularly the Zionist regime of Israel, are fully aware that Iran's nuclear program is completely peaceful. Yet, they are opposed to Iran's advancement in any field, as they don't want the Islamic Iran to become a role model for other nations which seek freedom and independence.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Thank you.